You're listening to Friendly Connections, the podcast of the Friends of the St. Paul Public Library. I'm your host, Chase Maxwell. Today's episode features a recent talk on romantic relationships given by leading F. Scott Fitzgerald scholar, Dr. Scott Donaldson. The talk was the inaugural presentation of the annual Richard P. McDermott Fitzgerald Lecture presented by the nonprofit organization Fitzgerald in St. Paul. The talk was presented on May 8, 2015 at the University Club in St. Paul, Minnesota, and was co-sponsored by the Friends and Common Good Books. One of the nation's leading literary biographers, Scott Donaldson has written 8 books about 20th century American authors, including Fool for Love, F. Scott Fitzgerald, and Hemingway vs. Fitzgerald, The Rise and Fall of a Literary Friendship, as well as the recently published book, The Impossible Craft, a Literary Biography. A Minnesota native, Donaldson began his writing career as a newspaper reporter and editor in Minneapolis, but later received his PhD from the University of Minnesota and now is Professor Emeritus at the College of William and Mary. Fitzgerald in St. Paul is a recently established nonprofit organization created thanks to a bequest by Richard P. McDermott. The organization is dedicated to celebrating the life and literature of F. Scott Fitzgerald, the revered American author and cultural icon, especially in his hometown of St. Paul, Minnesota. For more information, visit FitzgeraldInSt.Paul.org.
Thank you very much, Stu. It's great to be back in the Twin Cities. I always love coming back here. Lived here my first 35 years, pretty much. I'm going to be talking tonight about the summer of 1924 and in the lives of Scott and Zelda Fitzgerald. They came to France in May 1924 to get away from the frantic party life in New York and Great Neck, a time, as Fitzgerald put it, of drinking and raising hell generally and getting almost no work done. So he and Zelda and their child, Scotty, came to Europe then for a fresh start, where he settled down to write a masterpiece. Never before, as he was later to write about it, did he keep his artistic conscience as pure as during the 10 months when he was working on The Great Gatsby. He achieved that novel despite, or perhaps because of, a crisis in his marriage. After a few days in Paris, and a week or so looking around the Riviera for a place to stay, the Fitzgeralds moved into the Villa Marie in Valescure, 2.5 kilometers from San Rafael, a beautiful house with high and cool above the beach with eucalyptus trees and parasol pines. While Scott immersed himself in the book, Zelda looked around for something to do. "What'll we do with ourselves this afternoon?" Daisy Buchanan asked. And the day after that, and the next 30 years. Zelda was somewhat bored. Scotty was taken care of by an English nanny they'd hired in Paris. Servants looked after the house and cooked the meals. Zelda went down to the Mediterranean for swimming, tanned herself to a biscuit brown, and began studying French. Seeking companions during the long summer hours, Zelda met 3 young French aviators who were stationed nearby. The 4 of them played tennis together, sunned, went swimming. They chatted as well as they could, Zelda working from her French-English dictionary. And after a time, she paired off with one of the aviators. The aviator was the daring one, the one who flew his seaplane low over the roof of their Villa Marie, the one she danced with in the evenings, the one she either did or did not have an affair with in July of that summer. The facts are beyond ascertaining. Nobody's around who was there 90 years ago. What's clear is that whatever happened opened a rift in the Fitzgeralds' marriage that could not easily be mended. Neither Zelda nor Scott tried to hush up the affair. Both of them wrote about it, talked about it, worried it obsessively. It stands as a crucial and a complicated chapter in their troubled life story. The incident also provides an excellent example of why this book is called The Impossible Craft, because of the difficulty of arriving at the truth of how it was between anyone of Fitzgerald's 90 years ago. 14 different biographers have made an attempt to arrive at something resembling the truth, some focusing primarily on Scott, some focusing primarily on Zelda. For evidence, they consulted such sources as the writings of both Fitzgeralds, Scott's ledger and notebooks, for example, letters written for psychiatrists treating Zelda's illness, and in their fictional recreations of that relationship. It took more than 30 years of biography treatment to get the facts straight about those French naval officers who swam into their lives in that summer. Arthur Meisner, in the first biography, The Far Side of Paradise in 1951, relied primarily on Scott's ledger and notebooks and on Zelda's novel, Save Me the Waltz, published in 1932. Meisner assumed that Zelda and one of the aviators had indeed had an adulterous affair, and he was interested primarily, almost solely, in the effect that this had on Fitzgerald. As he wrote, sexual matters were always deadly serious to him. His capacity for being hurt by Zelda was always very great. In a long paragraph from Save Me the Waltz, Meisner evoked the physical nature of Zelda's lover, a dark, romantic fellow with, quote, broad bronze hands, convex shoulders, slim and strong and rigid. Meisner's principal error, though, was to get this man's name wrong. So if you go back to that book, you'll find that his lover, Zelda's lover, was identified as René Sylvie. Well, there was a René, and it was Sylvie, not Sylvie, but he did not have an affair with Zelda and probably was gay. 11 years later, in his biography, Andrew Turnbull substituted another error for Meisner's. Like the previous biographer, Turnbull emphasized how shattered Scott had been when he discovered what was going on. He really believed in love and what two people could build against the world's cheap skepticism, Turnbull wrote. But he further speculated on Zelda's motives. At 23, almost 24, he wrote, she may have begun to fear that her looks were going. All right. Or she may have felt insufficient, basking in her husband's glory. Perhaps she was trying to make him jealous. Perhaps she was bored, and the seduction of the moment proved too strong. As to the officer's identity, Turnbull remained almost as mistaken as Meisner. He brought a new source, and this is what biographers do. They bring in a new source in whenever they can, and they make a great deal of that because it's something they've introduced to the record, so it therefore becomes extremely important. Okay, so this is an article that Fitzgerald wrote for the Saturday Evening Post in September 1924 called How to Live on Practically Nothing a Year, which they were trying to do in the south of France and might have actually accomplished if they hadn't been stolen blind by their brother Cook. And anyway, in that article for the Saturday Evening Post, Fitzgerald wrote, in half an hour, René and Babe, officers of aviation, are coming to dinner in their white ducks. Okay, then in parentheses, Turnbull acquainted Babe, not René, with Edouard Josanne. This is the first we hear of Josanne, misspelled, a name which he fetched from Fitzgerald's correspondence with Zelda's psychiatrist in the early 1930s. This was wrong in two ways. There was a Babe, all right, and he was probably René's partner, but Scott was not disguising Edouard Josanne as Babe, as he suggested using parentheses. Scott left Josanne out of the lighthearted magazine piece entirely as a complication perhaps too painful or perhaps too valuable to be wasted in a lighthearted magazine piece. at least Turnbull came close to getting the fellow's name right using Edward. Edward was accurate, and Josanne, as he spelled it, J-O-S-A-N-N-E, was close. That was how Scott spelled it. Well, he missed Edward, too. He left out the O. Fitzgerald was one of the world's worst spellers among great writers. Not until Nancy Milford's Zelda, a biography, was published in 1970, this is 20 years later, did anybody spell the lover's name correctly. She made it Edward Josanne, J-O-Z-A-N, which is correct. She knew it was correct because she'd had correspondence with Josanne, and as nobody else had previous to that, and had discovered a great deal. Okay. Now, this is not the end of the world, getting these things wrong, and perhaps maybe I'm making more of it than I should. It remained, though, for André Lavaute to establish the background of the three aviators. He was French himself. In his book, 1983 book, he fleshes them out as René Sylvie, who was the son of a Cannes notary public, Babet, whose surname is in some doubt, a veteran of World War I, who'd fought at Verdun and shared a literary bent with René, and of course, Edouard Josanne, J-O-Z-A-N, son of a middle-class family in Nîmes. Curiously, too, various biographers have presented conflicting accounts about Josanne's hair color. Meisner gave him curly black hair. Milford described his hair as dark and curling. However, Sarah Mayfield, whose book came out the year after Milford's Zelda, described him as having curly blonde hair, and so did Lavaute. Well, we have the only picture we have. We have a picture of Josanne as he was in 1957, when you could not tell whether he'd been curly blonde or curly black hair in his youth. But he went on to have quite a career. Whatever his indiscretions may have been as a young man, he was later won medals for valor and became an admiral in the French Navy. Well, these are not crucial matters, but they do indicate one of the problems of trying to get at the truth, I suppose. What most people are interested in is, did she or didn't she? Was she unfaithful? Well, if you take Josanne's word for it, she was not. Both for Milford, who he wrote letters to, and Mayfield, who actually interviewed him the following year, he maintained that he regarded Zelda as, quote, a shining beauty, and he was very attracted to her, but that this has been only a flirtation and no actual affair. The supposed infidelity, he wrote to Milford, was a joint invention of the Fitzgeralds. They both had a need of drama, Josanne wrote. They made it up, and perhaps they were the victims of their own unsettled and a little unhealthy imagination. Possibly so. Milford backed up this interpretation with an interview with Hadley Hemingway. The Hemingways came to know the Fitzgeralds the year after, in 1924. According to Hadley, it was one of their acts together. I'm just a quotation from Hadley. It's one of their acts together. I remember Zelda's face becoming very, very solemn, and she would say how he had loved her and how hopeless it had been, and then how he had committed suicide. Scott would stand next to her, looking very pale and distressed, and sharing every minute of it. Well, they apparently did do this performance. This does not really solve the problem of whether or not there was a serious relationship or not. Ernest Hemingway, unlike Hadley, felt certain that there had been an affair. In A Movable Feast, his book about Paris, and published in 1964, posthumously after his death, Hemingway wrote that Scott told him several versions of this story about something that had happened at San Rafael. And the first version he told me was of Zelda and a French aviator falling in love. It was truly a sad story, and I believe it was a true story. The other versions got better, really, but they never hurt you the way this first one did, Hemingway wrote. And he could still see, envision in his mind's eye, after hearing Scott's story, the lovers' single cedar seaplane, buzzing the diving raft, and Zelda's tan, and Scott's tan, and the dark blonde and the light blonde of their hair, and the darkly tan face of the boy that was in love with Zelda. So you get a little Hemingway verbiage there. So it's a kind of conflicting pattern. Most of the female biographers tended to think there had not been an affair. Most of the male biographers tend to think there had been. Among the female biographers, Sarah Mayfield was the most adamant about that. Their affair, she insisted, was nothing more than a summer flirtation, romantic, decorous, slightly comic. As opposed to Milford, you have Jeffrey Myers, who turns out biographies every 18 months or so. And he stands out among Fitzgerald biographers for having no doubt whatsoever about what happened. Others might speculate. He knows. Quote, after 5 years of marriage, Zelda feared that she had passed the peak of beauty and had to prove that she was still attractive to men. She felt her life was empty, resented Scott's successful career, wanted to make him jealous, and hence it was easy for Josanne, using his French charm, to invite Zelda to his apartment and seduce her. Well, presumably, the fly on the wall is Jeffrey Myers. Then he abandoned her, Myers wrote, leaving her suicidal. Perhaps with some insensitivity, Myers then wrote that he felt it had been a misfortune for Scott that the affair broke off. If Zelda had left him for Josanne in 1924, Myers wrote, Scott would have had another lost love to inspire his work and been spared the horrors of Zelda's insanity in the 1930s. So something happened. What did Scott do about it? According to Turnbull, he forced a showdown and delivered an ultimatum that banished Josanne from their lives. This is vaguely worded. What sort of showdown? What was the ultimatum? Milford took up the issue in greater detail. Her account drawn from Scott's conversation, Fitzgerald's conversation with a relative, as she puts, years after the event. Well, that relative was almost certainly Scotty Fitzgerald, hearing an account of what had happened from her father many years later. And she cooperated, Scotty did, with Milford initially, and then became extremely upset with Milford's book, which she thought was unfairly prejudiced against her father. Anyway, so according to this account that she heard from Scotty, so this is Scott to Scotty to Nancy Milford to us. According to this story, Zelda came to Scott in July 13th, and told him she loved Josanne and wanted a divorce. Fitzgerald became furious and insisted upon a showdown among the three of them. Josanne would have to ask for Zelda's hand in his presence and do it, the three of them. This confrontation never took place, although Fitzgerald created a similar one in the book he was writing on between Tom and Daisy and Jay Gatsby at the Plaza Hotel, and he rewrote that again in Tenders of the Night, when Nicole Diver is captured by a French mercenary soldier named Tommy Barbin, and Dick Diver is airbrushed from the picture. Milford added that in a burst of anger, Scott locked Zelda in her room at the villa, and that she apparently accepted that ultimatum passively, and the subject of divorce was dropped. Milford further linked that happening to Zelda's apparent suicide attempt in August, when, according to Calvin Tompkins, the biographer of Gerald and Sarah Murphy, the Fitzgeralds got to know the Murphys during that summer. They were both living on the Riviera. At about 3 or 4 in the morning, an ashen and trembling Scott Fitzgerald knocked on the door of their room at the Hotel du Cap in Antibes, which may be the most elegant hotel I've ever seen, with the news that Zelda had taken an overdose of sleeping pills and that Sarah Murphy got up and walked Zelda up and down all night to keep her from slipping into oblivion. In her biography, the year after Milford's, Sarah Mayfield dismissed that sleeping pill episode as every bit an absurd invention as the presumed suicide of the lover that Zelda and Scott enacted for their company. Because they put on this routine, of course, that does not mean it did not happen, that the suicide did not happen, but the relationship was there. Mayfield also expanded on the attractiveness of Admiral Josanne, who she had been very impressed by when she interviewed him. She found him unusually charming and handsome. She described him as a born leader, healthy, athletic, and vigorous, assured. In fact, blessed with all the qualities that Scott would have liked to have. So you begin to get the drift of Mayfield and Milford both as I suppose, feminist readings of the relationships. She also added that this is Mayfield for the first time that Scott became violently and irrationally jealous and threatened to wring the aviator's neck. This is a new take on what the confrontation involved. And that Josanne, as the younger and stronger man, rather judiciously refused to beat Scott up. In Matthew Broccoli's Some Sort of Epic Grandeur, which of course is by far the longest, most thorough, and probably the most important Fitzgerald biography ever written, there's only a page and a half of the 600 devoted to this incident, quite possibly because Broccoli was interested almost solely in Fitzgerald as professional career and in his life only to the extent that it affected that career. Broccoli also assumed, taking Hadley's word for it, that this was really just a routine they performed jointly and separately for their friends. But he did add about this supposed fist fight that Fitzgerald wanted to get into, a letter that Scott wrote in 1935 and 1936 to Dr. Robert S. Carroll of Highland Hospital in Asheville, North Carolina, where Zelda was incapacitated. In that letter, Fitzgerald falsely claimed to have been a boxer in his youth here in St. Paul, that he had sparred with the champion professionals Tommy and Mike Gibbons, and that he would have annihilated Josanne in 2 minutes had the aviator been willing to fight him. Well, this is 1935, 1936, when Scott is probably at the lowest at the nadir of his drinking and alcoholism. And the grandiosity that comes with alcohol seems to show through that letter. Anyway, reading through biographies of Zelda and Scott Fitzgerald, one is struck by how much the story and its interpretation changes over time as the evidence accumulates, and each biographer adds whatever he or she has discovered and what they think is important to the mix, because there are many things you can put in. It's what you choose to put in. As a biographer, you have more information than you can possibly get into a book, because otherwise it would go on forever. So you have to choose. And it's what you choose that will illustrate a truism about biography writing, that every biography conceals within itself the hidden autobiography of the person who is writing it. And this is true. This is the way it is. So you find out things about people so that when Milford and Mayfield see things one way and Jeffrey Myers another, we learn something about them as people, I think. Okay. As you read these different biographies, and I don't expect any of you ever will bother to do that, it does become almost indisputable, I think, that whatever happened 40 and some years ago in the south of France really mattered to the Fitzgeralds, their marriage, and to their careers. The strongest evidence for this is in the writings of the Fitzgeralds themselves. And here I refer you to the summer of this 24, when Scott's ledger and notebooks, also in letters that both Scott and Zelda wrote to her psychiatrists who were treating her for schizophrenia and other mental illnesses in the 1930 to 35. The ledger. This is Fitzgerald kept a ledger. It was a financial ledger, among other things. Put down the amount he was paid for each story of each year, and also the cryptic little notes describing what has happened in their life. So, July 1924, the big crisis, 13th of July, Zelda swimming every day. Why is that important? Well, she's on the beach swimming with Josanne. August 1924, Zelda and I close together. September 1924, trouble clearing away. October 1924, last sight of Josanne. According to Mayfield, Josanne asked for a transfer and got one. Fitzgerald's notebook, he started keeping those notebooks in 1924, so we can't be sure exactly when he put this in. He started keeping it in 1932, so we can't be sure when he put this in, but here's the comment. That September 1924, I knew something had happened that could never be repaired. Letters. Zelda to Dr. Oscar Farrell in Switzerland, our first psychiatric mentor. She cited the two great emotional events of his life. First, her marriage, for which she is ill-prepared by her Southern upbringing, and then all of a sudden coming up to New York and living in a very different kind of world. And secondly, a love affair with a French aviator in San Rafael. I was locked in my villa for a month to prevent me from seeing him. When I knew my husband had another woman in California, I was upset because the life over there appeared to me so superficial, but finally, I was not hurt because I knew I had done the same thing when I was younger. Scott, a letter to Zelda's psychiatrist in Baltimore, Dr. Mildred Squires, 1932. Her affair with Edouard Josanne, this is the way he spelled Edouard, in 1925, and mine with Lois Moran in 1927, which was a sort of revenge, shook something out of us. But we can't go on pain and pain forever. And yet I feel that's the whole trouble back of all this. All this, her mental collapse, his near descent into total alcoholism, he got over it, a bad time. Then there's the fiction. In Save Me the Waltz, Zelda makes it clear that she was tremendously attracted to a handsome young French pilot in this passage. He drew her body against him till she felt the blades of his bones carving her own. He was bronze and smelled of the sand and sun. She felt him naked underneath the starched linen. She didn't think of her husband, David. She hoped he hadn't seen. She didn't care. She felt as if she'd like to be kissing Jacques, which they called the lover, at the top of the Arc de Triomphe. Milford points out that this is explicitly sensual prose, at least as highly charged as anything Scott ever wrote. It's but one example, it's a telling example from Zelda's fiction. Then there was her book that she never finished called Caesar's Things. She was writing it in the last 6 years of her life. And it made for André Lavoie, again, to make the most of toward untangling the affair, working with what's in that unfinished and unpublished novel. The given names in Caesar's Thing are changed to emphasize the emotional interconnection between all three points of the triangle. The woman is called Jano, her husband Jacob, the lover, Jacques. The real reason that Jano embarked on the affair, Lavoie commented, was to break out of the purgatory in which Jacob had confined her. Her husband was wrapped up in his art. He was a painter. Incidentally, in the Save Me the Waltz, her husband's also a painter. He's doing his art while she merely sits and waits, feeling dispossessed and suffering from and withering away. So even when Jacob puts an end to the affair, he postpones dealing with it so he could finish a painting. Lavoie also went back to Fitzgerald's notebooks for some significant, some more significant insights. In the same section of the notes if you could read at the Firestone Library in Princeton, the same place as the note talking about September 24, something had happened that could never be repaired. Lavoie found two other comments relating to it. In one of these, Scott expresses compassion for Zelda. He was sorry, knowing how she would pay for her indiscretion. The other suggests that Scott himself had been complicit in allowing for or even arranging for the affair. It reads, feeling of proxy in passion, strange encouragement. Something of what that may have meant appears in Caesar's Things, for when Janno and Jacob in the south of France first encounter Jacques, this handsome fellow, Janno was reluctant to approach him, and Jacob, her husband, insists that she do so. Relatively little new intelligence about the affair was advanced in my biography or in those of James Mello and Jeffrey Myers. In Fool for Love, I discussed the way that Fitzgerald's story, Image on the Heart, published in 1936, parallels the events on the Riviera more than a decade earlier. In that story, the male protagonist has just been married to a younger woman and discovers that she had spent the day before their marriage with a French aviator. Although she maintains that nothing had happened, she offers him an annulment. The husband refuses, declines the offer, and they ride away on their honeymoon, the husband thinking that he would never know the truth and worried that the question might, quote, haunt their marriage like a ghost. Okay, I thought this was significant enough to bring in. So I also brought in an interview that Zelda had done in 1947 with Henry Dan Piper, who, author of another Fitzgerald biography, but one which does not mention the affair, so it's not in my list. But in that interview, Zelda told Piper that she regretted having flirted with so many men and never telling Scott how far she'd gone with them, letting him guess the worst. Inasmuch as he knew, Scott knew that he and Zelda had been lovers before they were married, he was forever somewhat dubious about her virtue. As Hemingway mentions in The Movable Feast, at their first meeting, this is at the Bar Dingo on Montparnasse in April 1925, the year after they've been on the Riviera, and the month in which The Great Gatsby was published, Scott, who'd been drinking a good deal, kept asking him questions. And one of the most important questions was, Ernest, did you and Hadley sleep together before you were married? And Ernest wasn't much help. I don't know, he said. I can't remember. That's Fitzgerald having fun. I mean, Hemingway having fun with Fitzgerald. Okay. It may be that after Milford and Lavote, there was not much left for latter-day biographers to find out, but there was still room to offer interpretations about it. In three 21st century books, Kendall Taylor, Sally Klein, and Linda Wagner Martin all attempt to understand what went on. And all of them come to share in common a conviction that the crisis in the summer 1924 led to a power shift in the relationship, in the family dynamics, allowing Scott to assume a position of dominance over Zelda. Taylor actually goes inside Zelda's head, well, the only biographer who's quite that bold or risky, and to explain that she'd resolved to have no more romantic liaisons after this and realized she would probably never be happy again, but that's the way it was going to have to be. Klein maintained that Scott appropriated the affair, in effect, to establish his position as the controlling partner. This is Klein's. The reason why Scott fictionalized and highlighted and heightened the romance to include these fabrications, that is to say, the confrontation, the fight. He made it into a duel, Fitzgerald did for Sheila Graham, between himself and Josanne, was that he was thus able to share it, once more taking over an important piece of Zelda's life. That she allowed him to do so illustrates her emotional dependency on him. To back up these statements, Klein once more went back to Caesar's Thing with its statement that once the affair was over, Janno grew indomitably loyal and devoted to Jacob, and that Jacob had somehow become the center of the whole business. Linda Wagner Martin's book, 2004, arrived at a psychological reading of the affair and its after effects that, like Klein, placed Scott in a position of dominance. Feeling certain that Zelda had indeed attempted to kill herself in late August 1924, Wagner Martin tries to imagine how it must have been for her once Josanne was banished from her life. More than ever, Wagner Martin was observed, she saw that she was in the control of her husband. Scott had the money, he had the power, he had the reputation. What would she do if she tried to leave him? How would she and Scotty live? And would she be emotionally strong enough to make the break? In Wagner Martin's view, Zelda was so beset with these worries that she adopted a posture of submissiveness, ceding all authority to her husband and becoming for a time a virtual Stepford wife. Wagner Martin says the marriage then descended into sadomasochism with Scott as sadist and Zelda as willing enough masochist. I find this unlikely. But she did contribute an important fragment to the tale drawn from the confrontation between Zelda and Scott in 28th May 1933 in the office of Dr. Thomas Rennie at Shepherd Pratt or Phipps, one of the two clinics in Baltimore, where a stenographer was in attendance. There's a 114-page transcript of that conversation. It's an ugly thing to read. Throughout the document, Scott repeatedly insisted that as the professional in the family, he should have access to whatever happened to either one of them for his fiction. According to his lights, Zelda had appropriated his material in writing about herself in Save Me the Waltz. And now she was threatening, this is 1933, to take even more by writing about her illness. This is the very time when he's putting the finishing touches on Tender is the Night, which, as many of you know, most of you know, depends upon the mental illness of Nicole Diver. And using Zelda's letters to him, for example, as ones that Nicole had written. He also went so far as to say, and to say twice, that Zelda had tried to destroy him by falling in love with Josanne while he was, quote, doing the best work of his life. This detail, and there's in some sort of epic grandeur in Bruckley's book, there's some reprints of documents and transcripts from that talk, but he didn't include that particular detail. In any case, so Scott accuses her of trying to destroy him, and Zelda responds, as far as destroying you is concerned, I've considered you first in everything I've tried to do in my life. At bottom, the conversation between the Fitzgeralds that May afternoon in 1933 boiled down to the issue of who was in charge. Zelda wanted to be free of her husband's criticism and control and to do her own writing or dancing or painting. Scott wanted and expected her to be dutiful to him as the breadwinner in the family. She criticized him for his reckless drinking and occasional cruelty. He disparaged her as an artist and as a psychological cripple and made for an ugly show of a marriage gone wrong, a marriage that may well have been beyond recovery after the summer of 1924 when something happened that could not be repaired, something happened that they had to pay for during the rest of their lives. Thank you very much.
We've reached one of the best parts of the podcast, the Q&A with Dr. Donaldson and the audience. To make it easier for you, the listener, I've summarized the questions and will read them. The first question is very much of the Jazz Age. Amidst the drama of the Fitzgeralds' marriage, were they also having fun? What was their social life like?
There certainly was a hell of a lot of partying early on. Zelda collapsed, I think it was in the fall of 1929. There wasn't much partying after that. Not between the two of them, anyway. Yeah, I think that the early part of their existence, Fitzgerald spoke of 1925 as a summer, a year of 1,000 parties and no work. for example, this is the year after the affair. And when he's finished with Gatsby, he starts to think about writing Tenders of the Night. It's going to take him 9 years to do it. But he posits a plot line for it then that changes over time. But yeah, there was a lot of drinking going on in Paris. But after the affair, Zelda pretty much threw herself, within a year or two anyway, into dancing, into ballet, into working with Madame Agarova in Paris, who she was a wonderful, famous teacher, who she more or less fell in love with.
The next question is about Zelda. She was officially diagnosed with schizophrenia, but how accurate is this diagnosis in retrospect?
She did have some physical illness, and she probably had an abortion in there too. I'm not an authority, a psychological authority, but many people would think that what's the phrase these days for bipolar?
Next up, an audience member asked Dr. Donaldson about the subject of one of his other biographies, Ernest Hemingway. What was Hemingway's take on the Fitzgeralds and their marriage?
Cruel. Cruel is the word I would use. Hemingway treated Fitzgerald very badly in his writing about him. I don't think this particular quotation about the lover buzzing the plane and so on is cruel, but he certainly attempted to belittle Fitzgerald in his Inimmovable Feast, where it's the document where he talks about him at the greatest length. Incidentally, he was so angry about Meisner's book, to which he'd contributed some of his own comments, and disparaged Meisner badly for his cruelty to Fitzgerald. It's an unhappy relationship. Hemingway versus Fitzgerald is a book I did about that friendship, and it's in six or seven languages. And I don't think there's a copy for sale for that.
The next question is about the reliability of the Fitzgeralds and the narratives they constructed about their own lives. How do we know if Zelda's discussions with psychiatrists were honest accounts of her condition?
I think that's a good question. I think in 1930, when Zelda's first hospitalized, I think she's been as honest as she can be. And I don't know why she would make up this relationship unless it existed. And I think the same thing is true in 1932 in Scott's letter to Dr. Squires, in which he's trying to be honest about it. Now, you go up 3 or 4 years later, the letter to Dr. Carroll, I don't believe it at all. That's the one where he's talking about being a fighter in his youth and all that sort of thing. But I think you can rely on them to try to... Scott really wanted her to get better. He really did, and I don't think he would have lied to her, and had no reason to do so, I can think of.
The audience member asked a follow-up question about the rivalry between the couple. How did this impact their marriage?
The jealousy between the two, the rivalry between the... Well, it's a difficult position for Zelda, she's got a famous husband. He's a wonderful writer. He's a professional. She's a very talented writer. He called her fourth-rate writer. It's pretty nasty. But she was, she probably never would have published that book if her name hadn't been Zelda Fitzgerald. Anyway. And she became quite a good painter. Very interesting paintings, anyway.
A great deal of attention was paid to Zelda's potential infidelities, but the next question is about F. Scott's faithfulness. Is there any evidence he had extramarital affairs?
Well, I mentioned the Lois Moran he admitted to, he certainly did have affairs after she was hospitalized, although I don't know how many. And of course, he lived with Sheila Graham the last 3 years of his life or so in Hollywood. when he was taking care of Zelda, paying for her hospitalization, paying for Scotty's schooling and prep school and at Vassar, and trying very hard to quit drinking. I see Fitzgerald's last 3 or 4 years as a kind of triumph when he did give up alcoholism and tried to fight off his alcoholism as hard as he could, and to be the best person he could, and to become, as he said, a writer only. And that's a kind of triumph he achieved. So it's too bad he had a program of 16 to 17 books outlined he was going to do in 1940 when he died. So might have been very different if he'd been able to live another 15, 20 years. I mean, he died in the middle 40s, after all. Young man.
The next question is about the Fitzgeralds' role as parents. Given the fractiousness of their marriage, Zelda's bouts with mental illness, and F. Scott's alcoholism, were they good parents?
Well, I got to know Scotty pretty well. She said they did as well as they could. She was embarrassed that Scott had a coming out party for her in Baltimore. Zelda was in one of her institutions. And so Scott was the only one there, and it was a semi-disaster, and because he got drunk. She never really, well, she forgave him everything, but that was one of the things that bothered her. And once he sailed an inkwell at her, and missed her, they got angry with each other. But she loved her father, she loved her mother. And she didn't get to know her mother very well. I mean, she was 7, I guess, when Zelda became seriously ill, and that's a little young to know someone. She was I really like Scotty. She became a newspaper person, a good left winger, and she died quite young. I was just talking tonight at dinner about people remembering a conference some years back when Zelda was here and Malcolm Cowley was here, and I was sitting between them at dinner, and I had the job Scotty was here, I'm sorry. I had the job for Scotty of refreshing her glass. Scotty liked to drink like a father. Anyway, she had brought her own bottle of dry vermouth and kept it under the table. And she did not want to call attention to herself by ordering drinks or anything like that. So my job was to notice when her drink got low, and I would pour something in her glass. And so she's not having a drink. Someone else is giving her a drink. And so that's the way she wanted to do things. But.
Finally, an audience member asked how Dr. Donaldson originally met Scotty Fitzgerald.
Well, I had to get in touch with her to get access to a lot of papers. Most of Fitzgerald's papers are at the Firestone Library in Princeton, and she let me look at everything except the psychiatric records. Milford is the only one who ever saw those psychiatric records. And after that, Zelda was so angry, she never let anybody else have access. Yeah, I went to see her in Washington, D.C. once, took her out to dinner. And after dinner, we went over to Georgetown and went to a bar called Gatsby's, where we had a drink, and sitting at the bar, this was in 1977, 78, and issuing from the vents over the bar was marijuana. So you could just sit there and get kind of high, sniffing the marijuana. So that's the only time I ever encountered that as a draw. Okay, well, thank you very much.
You've been listening to Friendly Connections, the podcast of the Friends of the St. Paul Public Library. If you enjoyed this episode, we hope you consider supporting the Friends of the St. Paul Public Library and its mission, Stronger Libraries for Stronger Communities. Learn more at thefriends.org. Follow us on Twitter at The Friends and on Facebook at facebook.com/friendsofsppl. Please consider subscribing to this podcast on iTunes.